From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment, the home edition. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, what can I say about a man who may be the only person on the planet to have played both Seretse Khama and Muddy Waters? I'm talking to David.
I love it.
David Oyelowo, whose directorial debut is The Waterman, a film which he also co-stars with an incredible cast. And David, it's a pleasure to have you here finally. I've talked to you so many other places. To get you on my little goofy radio show is a thrill for me. Thank you for doing this.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Elvis, we've known each other so long. You can't say my last name wrong. You can't say Oyelowo. It's Oyelowo.
Apparently, I can say it quite wrong. Oh, David, oh, yellow. Oh, yes, I can say it quite wrong.
You're in good company, though, Elvis. You're in good company.
There's so much to talk to you about here. But one of the things I've got to figure, the reason that The Waterman attracted you is finally, it's a resurrection story, isn't it? It's not only about literal resurrection and a ghost story, but it's also the story of a spiritual familial resurrection, too, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, that's the first time it's been described that way. And of course, you know, leave it to you to see that in the film. It is. It's about a young kid whose mother is ill. And, you know, she's ill enough that he's looking down the barrel of losing her. And so he decides to go and find or try to find this mythical figure who has the ability to cheat death. So on one hand, he's trying to preemptively resurrect his mother. But the waterman himself is someone who the myth is that he died in a flood over 100 years ago and was the only one to survive this flood. And he's sort of been doomed to try to find his wife in the waters in which she died and try to resurrect her because he has somehow been given the ability to cheat death.
I guess because you can't help but think about the earthly elements because of the use of the colors red and blue in the film.
Again, you're picking up on stuff not everyone picks up on. You know, it's a very elemental film. It has fire in it. It has water in it. And those elements intersperse with the air in a very real way. It's something that my director of photography and I talked about. It's the kind of thing that's buried in the fabric of a film. It's not necessarily something you want the audience noticing, but that's all part of the tapestry that hopefully makes it a rich viewing experience.
One of the fun things about this movie that I think makes it work really well is that it zones in on that ability that kids have to see a story everywhere they look.
Yes, and to see things in reality that open up their imagination and lead to fantasy. You know, that's one of the things I loved about films the likes of E.T. When I was growing up. Those were formative cinematic experiences for me because they were rooted both in reality and fantasy, but I also never felt talked down to as a child. I felt like my emotional intelligence was being acknowledged and respected. A child's ability to cope with the more difficult things in life through their imagination, through their fantasy, is something we obviously lose a bit as we get older, but it's, you know, it's incredibly necessitous to our development as people.
It's also being on the precipice of that age where you're asking yourself, or people around you are asking, if hanging on to imagination in such a strong way is the province of a child. And he's undergoing things that also have him on that precipice, too, dealing with his mother's situation. There's this chasm between his father and he. I mean, it really is a coming-of-age story in a lot of ways, too, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, when you're talking about coming of age, that denotes going from one stage in your development to another. And we are very much in this film watching a young boy having to deal with things that, you know, in our society, we often think kids shouldn't have to deal with, but the reality is they do. And sometimes because we try to shield them from those things, we rob them of their ability to cope with them. And even looking at this year we've just had with the pandemic, you know, there are things we haven't been able to shield our kids from, they've had to deal with. And, you know, a lot of them have managed to come through. I think there's a lot we're going to be dealing with in the wake of this pandemic. But, you know, talking about it, being open about it is the key. But the way that I've seen with my kids, and certainly we demonstrate in the film, is, you know, sometimes there's this rites of passage where a kid kind of needs to go on a journey, whether it's a literal one, a proverbial one, an imaginative or imagined one. In some ways, our film showcases all of that for the character of Gunnar.
The film is really about that way that imagination can protect children too. And Gunnar meets a young woman named Jo, who we finally get to see she's using her imagination to shield herself because she doesn't have the gift of an intact family that he has. And I'm trying not to give too much away, but I've got to think that soon the reasons that attracted you to this film, so many of them, are about how layered it is. It's a movie that you can take on any number of surface levels, but the more attention we pay, the more it has to offer.
Well, you know, it's very hard to find a film or a script, I should say, full of that layering that can be shared between the whole family. I mean, you can have three generations of your family watching this. It is what I would term, and our business tends to term, a four-quadrant movie. And those are hard to come by. I think Steven Spielberg did it best, certainly in the earlier part of his career. Films like this, for some reason, are lesser made. I think it's because we, certainly in the film industry, for some reason, have decided to undermine the emotional intelligence of young people. The company that does it so brilliantly is Pixar. But I think they get away with so much because it's through the sweetened pill that is animation. But, you know, you have films like Up and The Incredibles and Toy Story and more recently Soul, which is such a beautiful film, which deal with real big themes that the whole family can enjoy. And that layering you mention is in those films and hopefully is certainly in The Waterman as well. And that's absolutely why I was drawn to it, because I felt Emma Nidell's script worked on so many levels.
What you're talking about, too, with a number of those Pixar films that you mentioned, and this film, too, is finally, it's the healing balm or maybe the damage of belief. I mean, we were just talking before we started about Alfred Molina's character, and he gets a wonderful turn in the film. But also, it's about these belief systems that sort of keep people going, but also can divide them from the people around them.
And they are coping mechanisms as well. You know, there are things that, whether they are true or imagined, that help us make sense of our lives. And that is never more true than when you're a young person. And even though, as we've already said, in all of our lives, we go through this sort of rites of passage, this coming of age, but sometimes as your body is developing, your brain is developing, your emotions are developing, you need these casings, as it were, whether it be imagination or the love of a family or friendship, that help you get through, you know, the trauma of puberty, the trauma of awakening to the reality of mortality as well. These are things we're all going to have to go through. And the imagination is such a brilliant way to navigate those realities.
But there's so many ways in which the movie, in both sort of visual and narrative terms, touches on imagination. I mean, there's one scene with a samurai sword, and when we meet Jo, and especially when we see her out in the forest, the Lady of the Lake comes to mind for me almost. In some ways, I find myself thinking about Arthurian legend in this a little bit.
What we've tried to do is have a modern day adventure fairy tale movie that is evocative of all the things that we love about adventure and fantasy and literature. And, you know, one of the best compliments I'm ever paid about the film is people think it's based on a book, or is The Waterman based on an actual legend? And, you know, this all spilled out of the head of Emma Nidell, who had a very unique upbringing on a farm in Montana, growing up with her parents and her brother, and was a a child who had to depend very heavily on her imagination because they were really in the middle of nowhere, just their small family. Even down to the nursery rhyme we have for the Waterman in the movie, the idea is for it to evoke those stories, those fairy tales, those legends, those myths that we love in literature and maybe have even seen in books and film.
So many of these myths that are sort of alluded to here, that scene where he meets Joe, or in fact, when we as an audience meet her, and she's kind of in effect in a church, isn't she? Those kids sitting on pews listening to her tell this story.
Exactly. She has her followers. She has her disciples. She has built her identity around basically being a purveyor of fear. And you go on to find out later on in the film that she is doing that partly because of some of the fear she has in her own life. You know, the way she makes sense of it is to effectively share that and maybe even hand it off to other kids in a bid to make herself feel better about herself. But, you know, you picked up on this earlier in our conversation and you've just mentioned it again. And it's absolutely intentional, you know, the blue hair, the yellow hoodie, the fact that, you know, we first meet Rosario's character with both red and yellow. You know, these things, those colors mean specific things to me. I don't necessarily want to foist those meanings onto the audience necessarily, but, you know, the film, as I say, is very elemental. You know, different colors evoke different emotions. You know, we really looked at the evocation of emotion with the score as well. These are the things that have been such a joy for me as a director. Obviously, primarily, I've been an actor in my career, and so you are only really affecting one specific part, a significant part of any given film or television show. But as a director, you touch on everything and the totality of the storytelling you are basically in the driving seat of, and that encompasses everything.
It's a treatment. I'm talking to actor and director David Oyelowo, I guess it is, about his first film as director, The Waterman. But as an actor, though, and we've talked about this, I think of you as somebody who approaches as being a storyteller anyway, and that this is a movie about people who all have their individual stories to tell and are so caught in their own worlds for whatever reason that they can't really communicate those narratives into each other. Feels like this kind of small-scale tragedy in the movie, because it's about, in a lot of cases, where we can be, especially in the case of Gunnar moving to a new place with a sick mom. I mean, it's a lot of sort of primal fears in this, isn't there?
One of the things I really enjoyed when I first read this script, and I think we've achieved it in the film, is the fact that love and dysfunction can coexist. They don't necessarily negate each other. And actually, that is the human experience, navigating the fact that you can be in a family that is struggling, but there's real love there. And whether that family stays together or breaks up or is facing challenges or not, tends to hinge on which of those things is taking precedent, the dysfunction or the love. And in the case of the Boone family, they have real challenges they're facing in the fact that Rosario Dawson's character is dealing with this illness. They have moved to this town where, you know, they are probably the only family of color in this society. Which,
what do you mean, David? When your character describes a Chinese restaurant as a Chinese restaurant that has only country western music and playing in it, I mean, I think there's no better way to sort of set up how lost somebody can feel is, and then in one sentence.
You see, you get it. You know exactly what that means. So they are dealing with all of these things. But what I love that we've also been able to achieve is that, yes, they're a Black family, but their struggles are not necessarily rooted entirely, or in fact, in any real way, in race. It's the stuff that we all have to deal with in life if we live long enough. And again, that was one of the wonderful things to be able to lean into, was this the normalization of a family that in this kind of narrative would otherwise be marginalized.
Well, we will take a break and talk more with our old friend David Oyelowo about his directorial debut. The film is The Waterman. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm working on getting the name right. It's David Oyelowo. He's an actor, now a director. His directorial debut is The Waterman. It's The Treatment. Even though you take your time in setting it up, there's a lot going on in this movie. And are you doing that? It's kind of a misdirect in the same way that that legend at the beginning could, I think, make people think that this might be based on a true story or something else. I mean, because it's a movie that I think it demands so much of you, and I know that you're kind of a restless intelligence, and that it had to be something that really asked you to devote yourself in a number of ways, didn't it?
Look, for me, I think that when it comes to quote-unquote family films, what we really have been saying recently when we say family films is films for kids. And actually, no, a family film is a family film. It's for the entire family. And if you're going to make a film for the entire family, there's got to be something in there for everyone. So the film has to be working on many levels all of the time. You don't want it to be so cutty in that way that we have decided that young people are now so attention deficient that they need everything fast paced. And so it's going at the kind of pace that for their grandparents is just going to be like, this is unwatchable. Because the reality is, yes, they are probably more attention deficient than we were when we were younger. But if there are many things happening all at the same time, if there is a character at the center that they can identify with, if there's enough adventure, if there's enough vibrancy, if there's enough cinematic attention being paid, I think there is a chance. And we see it with films all the time that work on many levels. I actually think one of the things that our industry, the entertainment industry, is grappling with is that it is becoming harder to define what good films that audiences are embraces are as a genre. You know, Get Out being one of the best examples in recent history. Is it a thriller? Is it a horror? Is it social commentary? Is it a drama? It's just a great film whose protagonist can be identified with by a lot of, most of, maybe even all people because of how well Jordan Peele drew that world, that character, and there are so many layers going on all of the time. So absolutely, from an aspirational point of view, that's what I was trying to do with The Waterman.
But again, it's like a skipping a stone across a pond. It just, there's this kind of elision that goes on. You don't dwell on any of these things. You're there to keep the story going. But there are these, like you said, there are these subtle tensions that you can say without declaiming.
Yeah. And for those paying attention, they'll see it. And, you know, for those who aren't necessarily paying attention to those things, maybe they'll see other things. What I have loved with a film like E.T., for instance, which was a huge inspiration for this film, is that it was a different film for me when I watched it as a kid. It's a different film for me when I watched it when I was older. And it's now a different film for me watching it as a parent with my kids. And that, to me, is what great literature does, what great storytelling does. It sort of hits you differently at different stages in your life, if indeed there is enough layered into the film to satisfy you across the course of your life as you're gaining more knowledge.
Again, it's a movie that gave you a chance to play with a lot of different things, and I can feel the exhilaration in the filmmaking here.
Yeah, the exhilaration really comes from the opportunity to circumvent expectation on many levels in many ways. You know, when I grew up watching these kind of films that used to be the preserve of Amblin, that company that gave us so many of these kind of films in the 80s and 90s, I loved those films, but I never really got to see myself represented in those films. And so in a very subtle and maybe not so subtle way, to have a Black family at the center of this kind of narrative is something I have truly relished. But for it to not be the focus of the film, i.e. their race, is also something I have relished. The fact of the matter is, you know, it wasn't written as a Black family. When Emma Nadell wrote the script, it was set in Montana with a white family. Joe, as played by Maya Miller, was actually a boy. It was two boys going off on adventure together. The character that Maria Bello plays, the sheriff, was a man. in the film. And, you know, for me, I want to make films, I want to be part of films that reflect the world I actually live in. You know, I have 3 sons and a daughter, and I wanted to make a film that was an adventure film that both boys and girls could see themselves represented within. So that's why Joseph became Joe. And I wanted to populate the film with men, women, black, white, everything in between. And you see that as much as we were able to do it in the film. All of that stuff is intentional, but hopefully subtly woven in a way that, you know, doesn't feel like it's any way proselytory.
One of the things that the movies you're talking about that were inspiration and example for you is the way that kids consume fear as kind of almost an aphrodisiac in this pre-sexual kind of way. And it becomes this thing that binds them together. And we even see it in the way, in the story that Gunnar is writing and illustrating at the beginning of the movie, that also kind of throws this kind of subtle thing onto the fire. How's that thing going to play itself out? And it actually plays itself out beautifully. And that's why I said parable. Just when Joe is both kind of a griot and a preacher in that place. For me, the subtle story is I want to meet the person who left all that graffiti behind there. That's part of the story I wanted to get into.
Well, that's the serendipity of filmmaking as well. You know, we knew we needed some kind of magical terrain for this story to play out. We knew we didn't have to tether ourselves to the idea of it being Montana, which is where it was originally set. And so I wanted to find a place that felt magical without having to rely on visual effects. And the Pacific Northwest is just such an incredibly vibrant environment when it comes to the forests. And the other great thing is that it hasn't been overly shot for some reason. I mean, films like Twilight, even Stand By Me, which was another huge inspiration for this film, was shot there. Leave No Trace, which is another film I love that was shot there recently, used the forest to great effect. But you don't often see it in movies, as it were. And so I really loved being able to go into that environment and create the magic in camera, as it were, and to have an environment that felt magical but was also real for these kids, which was an evocation of what was going on in their lives. So in the film, again, I shouldn't give too much away, but, you know, what the kids perceive as reality for someone else is, well, that's a complete illusion. That's a fantasy. But again, you know, having the discipline to stay in the POV of the child was something that, you know, I'd learned from other filmmakers I've worked with, the discipline to really stay in that POV, regardless of what's going on in the periphery, was something that was key as well.
So often in this movie, and when people are inside, we're aware of the walls that divide them. You know, you so often have people going from one room to a next. There's one crucial dinner scene at the beginning and an echo at the end. Again, I don't want to give too much away, but so often in these interiors, there's a separation that really sort of like leaves the men cast out.
Well, you see, and this is why it's so important when one can and when it makes sense to make sure that you populate a film with characters, individuals who really reflect the world we live in. Two of those characters that you are now zoning in on as having a different attitude to things on the basis of their gender were originally male characters. And so that's how you have a richer environment for a film like this, when you allow it to be populated by different kinds of people. Because again, you know, whether it's something you're projecting onto the story or something that is actually germane and inherent to the story, it just adds layers. What you just said there is not something I intentionally imbued the story with, but it's just something that becomes apparent for anyone paying attention just by virtue of adding the right ingredients.
That's fascinating, because I think on some subliminal level, you must have been doing this, because these women, or these female characters, even Joe, are people who tend to talk to more than one person, who tend to be a bit more inclusive in the way that they address others than other men.
I can take credit for Elvis, but the reality is that it wasn't top of mind for me. It's just, you know, I've had this before when I've worked with female directors, for instance. You know, I've had projects that initially started with a male director and it skews things in a certain direction. And then a female director comes on board because for whatever reason, the other director left the project. And you see how very naturally, without changing the dialogue, without changing the setting, just the tone and the hemisphere of what is deemed important within the narrative just shifts. Not that one is better or one is worse. It just shifts. And that's great, you know, because at the end of the day, anything you make is the sum total of the ingredients you add. So you've got to be incredibly mindful of the ingredients you're adding, the fact that you feel it ultimately is going to be additive without really knowing what it's going to result in. And that's that layering you talked about earlier, you know, whether it's my conversations with my DP in relation to the color palette and the lenses we chose, you know, in order to be able to make these kids feel very small in a big space. The fact that, you know, I come from a Nigerian background. And so I wanted to see those colors in the production design and in some of the costuming and certainly in the score, which so often we only have Western classical instruments in those scores, but I really challenged my composer. I said, no, I want some African instrumentation in there. Not necessarily African music, but use African instruments and just see what that gives us by way of a slightly different tone. And so you add all these ingredients and what they amount to is not something that you can necessarily predict, but it's going to be richer for it.
You know, as you're talking again, that thing I talked about, that filmmaking excitement, I can hear it in your voice. I mean, you're revisiting this just in the abstract because we don't have the film in front of us and something you did a while back, but I can still hear all the things that drew you to it as you were discussing it.
Yeah, it's the greatest feeling in the world to corral great artisans around a fantastic story that feels like it reflects humanity. And for that endeavor to amount in something that even remotely works as something watchable. And we've had such a beautiful reaction to this film out of Toronto, where it premiered, and Urban World and the Ashland Film Festival. And, you know, there have been a myriad of places where it's been showcased to great, great reaction. And it's just a brilliant, brilliant feeling. I've been part of films that just simply have not worked with all the best intentions in the world. And it's not for a lack of effort or willing. And so, you know, to be part of one that feels like it's touching something human and relatable. Yes, you know, I am very drunk with glee at the fact that I had the opportunity and people seem to be warming to it.
I'm sorry to say we're out of time. So maybe you have to direct another movie sooner so you can come back. Or apparently you got other things going on. So I'm sure we'll find another reason to have you back. But it's a thrill to finally get a chance to talk to you in this context.
Oh, well, thank you, Elvis. You have been such a great supporter of mine. And we've had a few conversations like this in the past. But to be doing it with me, having been in the director's chair, is really quite special. So thanks for doing it.
Recording engineer here at KCRW, Desmond Taylor, who's also part of our production team with Paul Smith and Kat Yore, who also mixes the show. The show is edited by Rebecca Mooney, who was the producer. To better days, everybody. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.